Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories about Southeast Asia. The Italian city of Venice and the American city of New Orleans, Louisiana, are slowly sinking. So is Bangkok, home to about 10 million people. Officials in the city and scientists say that they do not know how long people will be able to continue living in the Thai capital. Thailand's military rulers are considering action. The National Reform Council wants the government to form a committee to deal with warnings that Bangkok could be permanently underwater many years from now. The San Seb Canal was built in Bangkok in the late 1830s. In a neighborhood near the waterway, walkways are breaking up. Walls on homes, small businesses, and an Islamic center appear to be bending. The area is sinking about 2 centimeters a year. That is 2 times the average rate for the rest of Bangkok. I don't know what to do, says Vijitri Puangsri. She has lived in the neighborhood for 44 years. Her home needs to be repaired every year because of the sinking ground. The walkway in front of her century-old house, where she operates a small restaurant, must also be repeatedly repaired. Somsak Kongpieng is one of her neighbors and a community volunteer. He jokes that if we come back to see him again in 20 years, the water level will be almost as high as his head. But he is also partly serious. That might be only a small overstatement in a city that is, on average, just 2 meters above sea level. Many homes and other structures were built on soft clay. Observers say 2 reasons for the sinking are a rising sea level and too much pumping of groundwater. Another reason, they say, is the decision by developers to build so many high-rise homes and offices. Developers keep building these high-rises because they earn a lot of money doing so. This kind of development worries those who are concerned about the rising water levels. Susharet Kuntanakulvong heads the Water Resources System Research Unit at Chulalongkorn University.
If you don't do anything, everybody will lose. Because the land yourself is sinking, your value of the land also down.
He and others predict that if no action is taken, repeated and long-term flooding will begin in the next 20 years. Such floods could last for 2 or 3 months and would cause serious damage to Bangkok's economy. The most recent major flooding happened during the rainy season in 2011. 13 million people were affected. More than 800 died. The World Bank says the flooding 4 years ago caused more than $45 billion in damage to the Thai economy. Last month, the Bangkok Post newspaper published an editorial called "Stop the City Sinking." The editorial said that even with the recent floods and new warnings, most Thais seem unconcerned. The newspaper called for the expansion of the city to be stopped, and it called for a complete halt of groundwater pumping. There are also calls to build seawalls to protect the city, which already suffers from frequent flooding. Such a project would cost billions of dollars. And even if the walls are built, nature could still eventually reclaim everything people have built in some unprotected low-lying areas. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. 2 years ago, the ruling party in Cambodia suffered a loss in support during the country's last election. Critics say Cambodian lawmakers are now trying to push through laws to prevent that from happening again. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Cambodia's Senate approved a disputed law affecting non-governmental organizations, or NGOs. The law gives the government powers to close any non-profit organization or group that fails to meet registration and reporting requirements. The law also gives Cambodian officials the power to close any group that endangers peace, national unity, or culture. The government claims the law will prevent terrorism and financial wrongdoing. The European Union, the United Nations, and the United States have opposed the law, and hundreds of aid groups called for its cancellation. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the Senate to protest the law. Opposition lawmakers boycotted the vote. Now, the law will be sent to Cambodia's king for final approval. U Virak is a political expert. He created a research group called the Future Forum. He says many new bills are being approved because Prime Minister Hun Sen wants to guarantee his party will win the 2018 elections. U Virak says Cambodia's ruling party believes many non-governmental organizations support the opposition. Many of these groups receive money from foreign governments. Mr. U Virak says the Prime Minister fears they will support a rebellion against his government. Mr. Hun Sen has ruled the country for more than 25 years. Another law would restrict the activities of Cambodian trade unions. Many unions support the opposition. The government also wants to establish limits on the internet. Observers are not surprised that it wants to do so because social media helped the opposition in the 2013 elections. The government says a law limiting use of the internet would help in the fight against computer crimes. Mr. U Virak says young people in Cambodia use social media sites, such as Facebook and YouTube, to show their anger with the government. He says that is why the government will seek to restrict them. The government says people should not worry about the new laws. Last week, Deputy Prime Minister Sa Kheng said Cambodians should not be afraid that the government will use the laws to suppress opposition. But the government controls judges in the country, and it has often used laws to abuse opponents. For example, the city court in the capital Phnom Penh sentenced 11 opposition supporters to up to 20 years in prison just because they were at a protest in the capital last year that became violent. Rights groups strongly criticized the court's decision. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. President Barack Obama announced the final version of his Clean Power Plan this week. Mr. Obama says the plan will reduce carbon pollution from power stations by one-third over the next 15 years. He said this is the single most important step the United States has ever taken in the fight against climate change. But his political opponents say they will fight the rules in Congress. They even plan to ask courts to stop them. Congressional Republicans say the president's plan will hurt states where coal is mined. They also say it will be costly to put in place and will raise electricity rates. Yet the head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is happy about the plan. Gina McCarthy says it will give her agency more power to limit carbon pollution from existing power plants. At the White House on Monday, the president said the EPA must act now because the effects of climate change are already being felt. In his words, "We are the first generation to feel the impact of climate change, and we're the last generation that can do something about it."
There is such a thing as being too late when it comes to climate change.
The president said, "We only get one home. We only get one planet. There is no plan B." One of the president's strongest critics is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He sharply criticized the new rules during a speech this week in the Senate. He said they would hurt states that depend on coal, like his home state of Kentucky.
"And in Kentucky, these regulations would likely mean fewer jobs, shuttered power plants, higher electricity costs for families and businesses. So I'm not going to sit by while the White House takes aim at the lifeblood of our state's economy."
Many power companies and other businesses are expected to oppose the Clean Power Plan. And about 25 states are expected to fight the plan in court. Experts say the Supreme Court will probably have to decide if the federal government has the power to put the new rules into effect. Senator McConnell has called on governors to refuse to accept the plan. It requires states to write their own rules and put them in place by 2022. That is 2 years later than the rules announced earlier this year. Mr. Obama said opponents of his plan should consider the effects of pollution on people in their states.
"So if you care about low-income minority communities, start protecting the air that they breathe and stop trying to rob them of their health care."
The president said his plan would reduce the number of early deaths from power plant pollution by 90%. And he said it would reduce the number of pollutants that can cause asthma attacks by 70%. Mr. Obama noted that Pope Francis, the head of the Roman Catholic Church, has said fighting climate change is a moral obligation. The president said he will talk to the Pope about the issue when Francis visits Washington next month. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Boarded Window. It was written by Ambrose Bierce. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
In 1830, only a few miles away from what is now the great city of Cincinnati, Ohio, lay a huge and almost endless forest. The area had a few settlements established by people of the frontier. Many of them had already left the area for settlements further to the west, but among those remaining was a man who had been one of the first people to arrive there. He lived alone, in a house of logs, surrounded on all sides by the great forest. He seemed a part of the darkness and silence of the forest, for no one had ever known him to smile or speak an unnecessary word. His simple needs were supplied by selling or trading the skins of wild animals in the town. His little log house had a single door. Directly opposite was a window. The window was boarded up. No one could remember a time when it was not, and no one knew why it had been closed. It surely was not because of the man's dislike of light and air. Sometimes he could be seen lying in the sun on his doorstep. I imagine there are few people living today who ever knew the secret of that window. But I am one, as you shall see. The man's name was said to be Murlock. He appeared to be 70 years old, but he was really 50. Something other than years had been the cause of his aging. His hair and long, full beard were white. His gray, lifeless eyes were sunken. His face was wrinkled. He was tall and thin, with drooping shoulders, like someone with many problems. I never saw him. These details I learned from my grandfather. He told me the man's story when I was a boy. He had known him when living nearby in that early day. One day, Murlock was found in his cabin, dead. It was not a time and place for medical examiners and newspapers. I suppose it was agreed that he had died from natural causes, or I should have been told and should remember. I know only that the body was buried near the cabin, next to the burial place of his wife. She had died so many years before him that local tradition noted very little of her existence. That closes the final part of this true story. Except for the incident that followed many years later. With a fearless spirit, I went to the place and got close enough to the ruined cabin to throw a stone against it. I ran away to avoid the ghost which every well-informed boy in the area knew haunted the spot. But there is an earlier part to this story, supplied by my grandfather. When Murlock built his cabin, he was young, strong, and full of hope. He began the hard work of creating a farm. He kept a gun, a rifle, for hunting to support himself. He had married a young woman in all ways worthy of his honest love and loyalty. She shared the dangers of life with a willing spirit and a light heart. There is no known record of her name or details about her. They loved each other and were happy. One day, Murlock returned from hunting in a deep part of the forest. He found his wife sick with fever and confusion. There was no doctor or neighbor within miles. She was in no condition to be left alone while he went to find help. So Murlock tried to take care of his wife and return her to good health. But at the end of the third day, she fell into unconsciousness and died. From what we know about a man like Murlock, we may try to imagine some of the details of the story told by my grandfather. When he was sure she was dead, Murlock had sense enough to remember that the dead must be prepared for burial. He made a mistake now and again while performing this special duty. He did certain things wrong, and others which he did correctly were done over and over again. He was surprised that he did not cry, surprised and a little ashamed. Surely it is unkind not to cry for the dead. "Tomorrow," he said out loud, "I shall have to make the coffin and dig the grave, and then I shall miss her when she is no longer in sight. But now, she is dead, of course. But it is all right. It must be all right somehow. Things cannot be as bad as they seem." He stood over the body of his wife in the disappearing light. He fixed the hair and made finishing touches to the rest. He did all of this without thinking, but with care. And still through his mind ran a feeling that all was right, that he should have her again as before, and everything would be explained. Murlock had no experience in deep sadness. His heart could not contain it all. His imagination could not understand it. He did not know he was so hard struck. That knowledge would come later and never leave. Deep sadness is an artist of powers that affects people in different ways. To one, it comes like the stroke of an arrow, shocking all the emotions to a sharper life. To another, it comes as the blow of a crushing strike. We may believe Murlock to have been affected that way. Soon after he had finished his work, he sank into a chair by the side of the table upon which the body lay. He noted how white his wife's face looked in the deepening darkness. He laid his arms upon the table's edge and dropped his face into them, tearless and very sleepy. At that moment, a long screaming sound came in through the open window. It was like the cry of a lost child in the far deep of the darkening forest, but the man did not move. He heard that unearthly cry upon his failing sense, again and nearer than before. Maybe it was a wild animal, or maybe it was a dream, for Murlock was asleep. Some hours later, he awoke, lifted his head from his arms, and listened closely. He knew not why. There, in the black darkness by the side of the body, he remembered everything without a shock. He strained his eyes to see he knew not what. His senses were all alert. His breath was suspended. His blood was still as if to assist the silence. Who, what had awakened him, and where was it? Suddenly the table shook under his arms. At the same time he heard, or imagined he heard, a light, soft step, and then another. The sounds were as bare feet walking upon the floor. He was afraid beyond the power to cry out or move. He waited, there in the darkness, through what seemed like centuries of such fear. Fear as one may know, but yet live to tell. He tried, but failed to speak the dead woman's name. He tried, but failed to stretch his hand across the table to learn if she was there. His throat was powerless. His arms and hands were like lead. Then something most frightful happened. It seemed as if a heavy body was thrown against the table with a force that pushed against his chest. At the same time, he heard and felt the fall of something upon the floor. It was so violent a crash that the whole house shook. A fight followed, and a confusion of sounds impossible to describe. Murlock had risen to his feet. Extreme fear had caused him to lose control of his senses. He threw his hands upon the table. Nothing was there. There is a point at which fear may turn to insanity, and insanity incites to action. With no definite plan, and acting like a madman, Murlock ran quickly to the wall. He seized his loaded rifle and, without aim, fired it. The flash from the rifle hit the room with a clear brightness. He saw a huge, fierce panther dragging the dead woman toward the window. The wild animal's teeth were fixed on her throat. Then there was darkness, blacker than before, and silence. When he returned to consciousness, the sun was high, and the forest was filled with the sounds of singing birds. The body lay near the window, where the animal had left it when frightened away by the light and sound of the rifle. The clothing was ruined. The long hair was in disorder. The arms and legs lay in a careless way, and a pool of blood flowed from the horribly torn throat. The ribbon he had used to tie the wrists was broken. The hands were tightly closed, and between the teeth was a piece of the animal's ear.
The Boarded Window was written by Ambrose Bierce. It was adapted for Special English by Lawan Davis, who was also the producer. The storyteller was Shep O'Neill. You can read and listen to other American stories on our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Faith Lapidus.